Before we get started, have you had an opportunity to read our policies and procedures regarding oral argument, and do you have any questions about those?
I have one question.
Yes, sir.
The rule says that I should begin as the appellate with a statement of the case, a concise statement of the case. Is that something that I could dispense with based on the fact that the court has read the briefs, or is that something?
Yes, you can.
Okay.
You certainly can. That's one of the things we mention often, is that you can make your argument in any manner you wish to make it. However, we would remind you that all of us have read portions of the record, and at least one of us has delved into it very deeply, and so we're very familiar with the facts, and probably we would encourage you to argue the law, what the law is regarding your claims that you have. Secondly, for the appellant, you can, of course, reserve some time for rebuttal if you wish to do so. The timing mechanism here is self-monitoring, and as you probably know, the light turns yellow. That means you have 5 minutes left. If you want me to try to assist you and let you know when you have a particular amount of time left for rebuttal, I can do that if you want to. If you'll just let me know when you can begin. Otherwise, let me remind everyone in the gallery to please turn off any cell phones or pagers or any other devices that might go off during arguments and interrupt counsel from their argument. With that, if there are no other questions, we're ready to proceed on People versus Swindle. That's 12 CA 2090.
May it please the court, counsel, your honors. My name is Malcolm Sewell. My attorney registration number is 20983. I do appear on behalf of the appellant, Anthony Swindle. The question upon which this court must pass and is framed, I believe, well by the parties in the brief, is whether the trial court abused its discretion in failing to find a fair and just reason for Mr. Swindle to withdraw his guilty pleas. The standard the court must pass upon is well articulated by our Supreme Court in Crum versus People. I think it's important the court note that the timing of Mr. Swindle's request to withdraw his plea, being under Rule 32, the standard being a fair and just reason, the court should look favorably upon that timing in terms of its exercise of discretion with regard to whether there are good grounds to grant that motion. Based on the issues in the trial court, and as they've been briefed to your honors, really the sole issue that we have here on appeal is whether justice was subverted by denial of Mr. Swindle's motion. It was confessed that the motion was made in a timely manner. The people confessed the fact that they were not prejudiced in terms of the presentation of their case by the timing of the motion, and that Mr. Swindle moved promptly for setting aside those guilty pleas.
So let me jump right in here. Your brief was well done. Both briefs in this case are well done. The question, as you just said, is whether the denial of the motion subverts justice. I think that's where we're at. You make a very compelling case that the facts changed very dramatically from where they were when your client pled. I understand your argument. And I guess what I'm struggling with here is your client ultimately pled to the robbery or attempted robbery, conspiracy to commit robbery, which he basically admits he did. So why would it subvert justice to say the motion is denied when essentially what he would be stuck with is what he admitted he did? Is that clear?
It is, Your Honor. Yes.
Articulate that well.
And I would correct the court in one respect. The court indicated that my client pled guilty to attempt to commit robbery. That would be a class 4 felony, attempt to commit aggravated robbery. In fact, he pled guilty to 2 counts of a consummated crime of aggravated robbery. So, in point of fact, he did confess to conspiracy to commit aggravated robbery and attempt to commit robbery. He did not confess, and it wasn't a consummated crime for the offense of aggravated robbery as a Class 3 felony, and so he pled guilty to higher offenses, in fact, double the presumptive range of the offense to which he had confessed his involvement by virtue of the plea agreement to avoid liability for felony murder under the known facts at the time he entered his plea. And to that point, I think that really strikes at question of the court, strikes at the heart of, you know, what would have been had my client been operating under the correct facts at the time he entered his plea. And he was deprived that opportunity by the trial court's failure to recognize that the significant change in factual circumstances gave rise to considerable defenses to that charge of felony murder that he would not otherwise have had in this particular case, but for the victim of the attempted robbery, Mr. Andrew Porch, having subsequently confessed and admitted to having killed his partner.
In terms of his exposure to liability, though, isn't it the same regardless of who had actually fired the shot in this setting?
Well, I think that's what the trial court ruled, and that's certainly what the people have argued in the brief, and that's what I take the most exception to in my brief. I think it is patently a different circumstance where you conspire with someone, knowing that person is armed, to commit a robbery. You take your place in that robbery, and you believe, and you enter pleas after there's been a death, when your understanding is that that death occurred at the hand of your confederate as he is fleeing and making chase towards the person that committed this or had the object of the robbery, this marijuana, at the time the fatal shot was fired, killing Mr. Rowe. And so when you break it down and you look at, well, what facts really changed, can we sit back in the setting of maybe a law school examination and say, well, you know, you have these facts, and could these facts potentially give rise to a cause of felony murder when you know that it was in fact the person that was the subject of the robbery, a non-participant in the underlying robbery, who shot and killed his partner in this ostensible drug deal? And my position, and I think a position in terms of how those facts would be presented to a jury, would conclusively show that you do now have defenses where you previously did not. If the court looks at, in the case of Almond versus People, or People versus Almond, that's briefed and cited by the trial court, in the trial court's decision in this case, one of the things I think that the trial court touched on, but didn't really give a breadth of analysis to, is whether this act of Mr. Porch in obtaining this weapon that his confederate had brought to the scene, shooting and killing his friend after he had subdued the person that was trying to steal the marijuana, Mr. Braithwaite, constituted an intervening cause that broke the causal connection between what my client conspired to do, the aggravated robbery, from the death of Mr. Rowe.
Well, do we even need to get there, Mr. Sewell? I mean, and thank you for your clarification on the facts. I just, that went past me, and I apologize for that. In this case, I think your argument, and Almond also says, you got a fact question as to whether the Confederate was still in flight in that case. And here, my question really is, do we have to get to this intervening cause argument? Isn't your argument really, the jury could have found here, I got a case, a defense I didn't have before, because it's a fact question whether anyone was in flight. There's a fact question whether this robbery was still going on. In other words, we don't have to decide these questions, I think. But correct me if I'm wrong. You're saying, I have now factual defenses I didn't have before.
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. In terms of an argument as to whether the murder occurred during the course of this attempted aggravated robbery, at the point in time when the death occurred, the object of that robbery was out of the scene. Mr. Braithwaite, the person that was trying to take the marijuana, the person that conspired to take the marijuana with my client, was no longer pursuing it. he had, according to Mr. Braithwaite's statements at his allocution at sentencing, had said he was done, he was no longer pointing the weapon at Mr. Roth. And so I think there's a huge question there as to whether you could argue, and I think it can plausibly argue, and I think a jury can find, that that death did not occur during the course of that attempted robbery. That's the predicate crime that gives rise to felony murder. If that crime is over, it didn't occur during the course of that robbery.
The course includes an immediate flight from there.
And that being as a separate element of the felony murder, I agree. And my argument to the court would be, as stated in Ahman, it includes during the course of fleeing or during the furtherance of fleeing. And so quite clearly, an act of shooting the person that is also the subject of the robbery by his partner, Mr. Porch of Mr. Roth, could not be in any way furthering my client being able to flee the scene of the robbery or Mr. Braithwaite being able to flee the scene of the robbery. A better question would be whether it was during the course of the fleeing from the attempted robbery. And I would argue to the court that at the time that homicidal act had occurred, there was no evidence that Mr. Braithwaite was attempting to leave the scene of that robbery.
If I can back you up, Mr. Sewell, for a minute, going back to the furtherance of, as I recall it, and I hope I don't get the names all mixed up, it was the testimony here that changed was now we have Braithwaite supposedly pointing a gun at the decedent. And that's when, you know, the, it was a Porch who fired the shots.
That's right? Correct.
Now, if those were the facts,
yes,
and I recognize you say maybe you don't believe what this man is now saying, but if those were the facts, why wouldn't that be still in furtherance of the robbery? I get that the guy with the marijuana is now outside, but he's looking at the guy who was committing the robbery holding a gun to his friend.
I would argue that it could be a wholly independent crime that Mr. Braithwaite at that point is committing against Mr. Roth by holding the gun and menacing him in that context, because it has nothing to do with what my client conspired with him to commit, which was very singular in purpose, which was to obtain that marijuana.
Well, let's take just a hypothetical on this. So say we've got, you know, A and B are, you know, the guys who are the victims of the robbery, or the supposed victims, right? So the perpetrator comes and he's got a gun on both of them. One of the guys breaks away, but he's still holding a gun on the guy who's still standing there. Why isn't that still part of the robbery?
That's a hypothetical.
Yes. Would that be part of the robbery in that context? So he's robbing both of them. One guy goes away. Say it's the guy with the marijuana he's trying to steal. The other guy's still there. Isn't that part of the same transaction?
I would confess that it could be.
Okay.
And the problem we have is that by the court making a trial court, making a determination here that there weren't good grounds to flesh those issues out in the context of a trial with somebody whose credibility is questioned by their own mouth, it deprived Mr. Swindle of that opportunity to explore that issue and develop that issue and have a jury as opposed to a judge, which is his right, to pass upon that question. And so I would argue that things in terms of the time, the temporal proximity to Mr. Porch's leaving the scene and coming back, and the interaction between Mr. Roth and Mr. Braithwaite, what that purpose of that interaction was, would be very relevant issues at the trial and would be hotly litigated, but we didn't have that opportunity in the record at the time that the trial court made the determination that it did, depriving my client of the right to have a jury pass upon that issue. If I could reserve the rebuttal time, I would appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
Feel free to lower that podium, Ms. Wiggins, if you'd like. It's on the right. There's 2 hours up in there.
I think a little lowering would be good, Your Honor. I agree. May it please the court, Nicole Wiggins, registration number 42702, on behalf of the people today. And Your Honors, I want to start with basically what the defendant is coming here and asking this court is that a change in fact changed everything for him. Changed whether he would have entered his plea, changed the defense he might have had to his plea. And the response I have to that is even under the change, and I think the key fact here is in the beginning set of facts and the second, the marijuana's outside the building. In both instances, Mr. Porch is outside of the building, and as defendant says, the object of the robbery was no longer there. That did not change in this second instance. So to the extent the defendant is arguing that because the marijuana was no longer on the premises, that the robbery was no longer in furtherance, the new facts didn't really change that. So the court was correct in ruling, number one, that it was still in furtherance factually. But number two, as we stand here today looking at the two different stories and how it changed the landscape for the defendant, under both circumstances, Mr. Porch was outside the apartment complex with the bag of marijuana on his back.
But that wasn't really the only fact that Mr. Sewell's arguing. I mean, I think it seemed to me the more critical fact is who shot anybody here? In the scenario that Mr. Swindle understood, it was his co-defendant who fired the fatal shot. Now he learns after the fact, it wasn't his co-defendant at all. It was the original victim. And so I guess my question for you, Ms. Wiggins, what's troubling me here, how is the shooting in furtherance of the robbery when the victim of the robbery is gone and he's the shooter? I mean, that's at least isn't that dramatically different facts from Mr. Swindle's point of view?
It's dramatically different facts from his point of view, but it doesn't legally change any of his defenses. I'm sure from his perspective, he was quite surprised, seeing as though he wasn't there at all to begin with. But it doesn't change, the felony murder rule says basically we don't care. We don't care as long as someone is killed in the furtherance and it's not one of the felons.
But how is it in furtherance? I'm struggling with how is it in furtherance of the robbery? In the robbery over when the guy who's being robbed is outside and he's the one who fires the fatal shot?
Your Honor, I think the situation here is that the robbery is a bulk of them from the beginning. Because what happens is, and the defendants are surprised that Mr. Porch arrives with someone else, but he in fact does. And though it's very clear from the beginning that those two are together, that this transaction is occurring between the defendants and these two men. And so once that occurs, you know, Mr. Rope at that point is a victim as well. He's being held at gunpoint the same as Mr. Porch. So in the sense that all the felons are responsible for what each of them do, these two also were confederates, if you will, and they came together. They were both held at gunpoint, so at that point we have two victims, Your Honor. And because one victim is still inside being threatened, this crime is still ongoing. Also because relatively maybe 15 to 20 seconds, seconds have passed at this point, we're still at the scene of the attempted robbery. There's just no attenuation of between the felony and the murder at this point, Your Honor, or at any point in this case.
Ms. Wiggins, let me ask you this. Does it make any difference with regard to the commission of a robbery that the marijuana is there? What if the marijuana wasn't there?
Your Honor,
Would there still have been a basis for a robbery offense?
Yes, Your Honor. I guess my question would be, are you saying if the marijuana was never there, or?
Well, what I'm asking is, you're saying that both victims were there, Mr. Porch and Mr. Roth. Roth was inside, Porch was outside.
Mm-hmm.
Porch had the marijuana, mm-hmm. correct? And we know that the primary purpose of the meeting was to rob Porch of the marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
But my question is this, could there still have been a robbery even if Porch had departed, had gone, the marijuana was not around? We don't know what Roth had in his pocket. We don't know what the intent was that Braithwaite had as to Roth.
Your Honor, I do believe that there's still a robbery. A case that is cited by several cases, not by me or the defense, but by other cases that we do cite, case of Whitman, actually says that the robbery doesn't end in the split second the object of the robbery leaves the scene. And I think that would be a good case to answer your question, and I apologize that it wasn't briefed. But I think that applies here. Just because the marijuana has left the scene, so to speak, doesn't mean that the current crime or robbery is not ongoing. The robbery in the sense is not, at that point, it's the threat, it's the weapon, and the fact that the object has left doesn't slow it down. In fact, if things had occurred differently, perhaps the crime would have proceeded as they chased them along. So I don't think that just because the original object of the robbery is no longer present physically, that that ends the crime. I don't think that any of our case law, including Ammon and McCrary, I think would stand for the fact that they didn't specifically address whether the object left the scene. Whitman does that more so. But just the fact that basically this can be an ongoing situation without essentially all elements of the robbery in place at the same time.
Ms. Weeks, I think you make a fair point. I mean, I understand your argument. But doesn't Allman at least create a fact question here? I mean, so the question, I don't disagree with what you said. I think a jury could find felony murder here. But don't we have on the new facts, if you will, at least a factual question that we didn't have before under Allman? That now there's at least a question whether the robbery whether we're in furtherance of it, not only because the marijuana is outside, but because the victim is the guy who's doing the shooting. And it's not clear to me who's in flight anymore, because under the original facts, as I understand them, please push back if I did it wrong. The original facts, as Mr. Swindle understood them, is Mr. Brathwaite turns around, he's leaving the robbery, he turns around and fires the gun. That, I think, on anybody's interpretation, is if not in furtherance of, he's in flight. He's leaving and turns around and shoots the victim. That is clear felony murder. Now the facts are somewhat different. And I guess my question is, isn't there at least a factual question under Allman? And then we can discuss whether that makes a difference. But do you not agree that there's at least a fact question that didn't exist before on furtherance of the crime, furtherance of the robbery, and flight?
Your Honor, I have to disagree. I don't think that Allman really opens the door here. I think when read in conjunction with a case like McCrary, where there's such a space of time, and we're still saying felony murder liability is ongoing. I think what's maybe throwing the court is the fact that now there's a victim, but the felony murder statute doesn't distinguish between that. And it doesn't matter to the felony murder statute or the case law interpreting it that now the victim is the shooter. It's a terrible accident. But under the statute, it doesn't matter. And that might be a fact that will cause the jury to look up, but it doesn't change the legal framework. And I don't think Allman opens the door. If anything, I think Allman broadens felony murder liability. If anything, I think it extends it.
But there's a trial in Allman. I mean, the court said there's a fact question.
True.
And the jury could say, yeah, that was within furtherance, good enough. I mean, here the question really is, I think, and again, pushback, whether this would have affected Mr. Swindle's calculus in the plea negotiations. I mean, at least Mr. Swindle makes the argument that I got no defense to felony murder on the facts as I first heard them, and so that's why I'm going to plead to something higher than the attempted robbery. Now I got some defenses, and maybe that changes the plea negotiation.
I don't think the question for the court is really whether a jury would buy his new story. I think the question for the court is whether the trial court, he entered into the plea knowingly and willingly. We've already discussed that he flat out admitted everything that he did in this case. The question is not, would any jury in the country buy this? The question is, did the trial court abuse its discretion in saying this doesn't change anything? And I don't believe that the trial court did that on the face of the felony murder statute. In any of the cases, McCrary, Allman, both of those cases are almost extending the statute way beyond what we're talking about here.
Here's a citation of the Whitman case.
Your Honor, I do over here, and I can give it to you now, or I can give it to you later. It's up to you.
Either way.
I'll grab it. Oh, maybe it's here. Your Honor, the Whitman case is 420 PD 416.
Let me ask you about the felony murder statute that you were just talking about. Under the terms of the felony murder statute, to whom does the phrase or immediate flight therefrom relate to?
Your Honor,
Is it Swindle in this case? I mean, we're Swindle. I'm looking at, it says, a person commits the crime of murder in first degree when he or she commits or attempts to commit, and in the course and furtherance thereof, or immediate flight therefrom. So,
Your Honor,
who does that apply to in this situation?
I think that's an excellent question. I don't think any of the cases briefed address that question. I would speculate that it is applying on its face to the felon, because that is what most of the statute is referring to, but there's no case law that limits it to that, and the statute doesn't limit it to that. I think in this case, the trial court correctly found the crime was ongoing. I think even if that was untrue, that the brave flight character would be considered to be in flight and that the statute would still apply. I do think that's a good question. I don't think any of the case law addresses that. I think
Elman might. I mean, because in Elman, it was the Confederate. It was the guy who was supposedly in flight. I guess if I could pick up on Judge Hawthorne's question, though, let's assume that, for argument's sake, that it could be any of the Confederates here involved. Who's in flight in this case, under your scenario? I mean, we have, under the facts as we now know it, Brathwaite is still sitting there in the room with the victim. Swindle was long gone as part of the game. Who's fleeing?
Your Honor, I would argue that Braithwaite at that point, well, we have two versions, essentially. We have the version that Mr. Porch tells, which is when he reapproaches the apartment complex, Braithwaite is holding a gun to the other victim. And in that case, I would argue he's attempting to get out of there without this guy stopping him, so Braithwaite could be in flight. In the second instance, or in the other scenario, wherein Braithwaite is saying, no, I wasn't doing that, either way, Your Honor, he is in flight from a crime. Unless he sits there and waits for the police to come and says, here I am, he's leaving the scene of a crime that he committed. And I would argue that any time he leaves that scene, that's flight therefrom.
But there was no death while he was in flight. He's standing there when he gets shot first and then falls back, and then the victim gets shot.
So, Your Honor, I think we're talking about, I guess, like a matter of seconds at that point. I don't think...
Sure, but is he running away when, say, it's two immediate shots? I'm having trouble seeing how Braithwaite is fleeing anywhere. He's standing there.
Right, Your Honor, in the process of trying to get out of there.
Oh, okay.
I guess is what I'm arguing. I think the defendant wants us to believe that the guy with the gun and the victim are just standing there having some sort of conversation. And I just don't think that's likely. It appears that he was standing there maybe for a second, but he was very quickly out of there. Porch says, you know, basically I look up and he's gone. So he did quickly flee the scene, and I do think him brandishing the gun and everything he was doing inside of that apartment complex was designed to get him out of there without getting in trouble. And Your Honors, I see that my time's running short, so I just do want to point this out. Regardless of that the timing necessarily when the shot happened, the crime is still ongoing after that. When the defendant comes back and helps Braithwaite get into the car, get into the hospital, they get rid of the gun, all of that is part and parcel of this conspiracy to commit aggravated robbery. So even after the shooting has occurred, this aggravated robbery is ongoing. The officers who testified in the withdrawal hearing in this case testify that this all happened within a matter of minutes, that there was never at any point a break in this conspiracy or in this crime. I think the felony murder statute on its own, right in conjunction with Allman and McCrary, will lead us to the conclusion that the only change in circumstances here still subjects the defendant to the same liability under the felony murder rule.
Can I pick up Ms. Wiggins on that time zone? Where you just said, where's the line when this crime ends? We all know Swindle went off and hit. If he hit for 4 days and then he comes back later to attend to his friend, would you still say that the conspiracy was ongoing because he hasn't been caught yet?
I guess
I'm not sure where the line is.
I think that's quite possible, Your Honor. That depends. Has he been in contact with his other co-defendants? Have they been conspiring to stay out of sight? Stuff like that. It's very much like a rest, J, stay analysis, where there is no bright line, but we have a lot of case law trying to guide us there. In this instance,
like I said, the officers told us it was minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. The people ask that the trial court be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Sewell, you have about 3.5 minutes.
Thank you. To address a few of counsel's arguments, the point that the marijuana was out of the scene at the time of the homicidal act is very different under the circumstances under which the death occurred, because Mr. Porch, by all accounts, left the scene of the attempted robbery first. Marijuana's in his backpack. Under the original set of facts, based on what Mr. Porch originally told law enforcement and Mr. Swindle believed at the time he entered his guilty pleas, he shot back in as he fled on the heels of Mr. Porch, a very short period of time after Mr. Porch left with the marijuana, shot back into the scene, striking and fatally wounding Mr. Rowe. That is a very different circumstance, as pointed out by the court, where that is an absolute circumstance, even under the most traditional formulations of the felony murder rule, where liability attaches for a death that occurs during the course of furtherance or immediate flight from the scene. As the court has raised through its questions, and I think it's obvious, there are several and many and various questions that arise as a result of Mr. Porch correcting his lie and admitting to the fact that he's the one that caused the death of his partner. The people argue that because theoretically Mr. Swindle could remain liable for felony murder, the trial court did not abuse its discretion. The standard, however, is simply whether Mr. Swindle, at the time he made his request to withdraw his plea prior to sentencing, had reasonable grounds for taking the case to the jury. The case of Champion, that's cited in the appellant's brief, stands for the proposition that at least where someone gives any reasonable grounds for going to a jury, the court should exercise its discretion in favor of life and liberty. Under the circumstances of this particular case, Mr. Swindle is, based on his behavior, and will continue to be punished for his role in this attempted robbery. What's unjust is that his punishment reflects a belief that he was responsible for the homicide of Roe when there are significant issues of fact or unknown, and strongly convinced that he is not responsible. Mr. Swindle is simply asking for an opportunity to present such issues to a jury. There's a case cited in the appellant's brief, Abad versus People. Mr. Abad entered into guilty pleas following the entry of his guilty plea, but I believe prior to sentencing, some issues arose with regard to his sanity. There was a factual dispute as to whether he was sane or insane at the time. The trial court made a determination that those were not fair and just reasons for him to withdraw his plea, essentially made a factual determination under those circumstances that Mr. Abad was sane. The Supreme Court held that no, where you have those factual issues, those cases should go to a jury, should have that opportunity. That's what I'm asking for, Mr. Swindle. Thank you for your time.
Sure. Mr. Sewell, we realized that, I think it was the Whitman case that counsel brought up wasn't cited previously in the briefs. Do you want to respond to that, or do you want to respond in writing?
I would welcome the opportunity for both. If I could just briefly address that issue, and thank you for bringing it to my attention. My understanding from vague recesses of my mind coming across that case and all the cases that I've read is that Whitman was a consummated robber. The perpetrators of the robbery had obtained the object of the robbery, were leaving the scene with the object of the robbery. I would suggest that it would be a substantially different question if Mr. Braithwaite had obtained that marijuana and was leaving with that marijuana at the time a death occurred of a non-participant. I believe that given the fact that under these circumstances, so because the object of the marijuana was not obtained, issues are raised concerning Mr. Braithwaite's statements, of abandonment and whether the course of that attempted robbery continued to be effective.
Okay, I think in light of that statement, we are apprised of this case and we'll take your statements into account when we read the case and consider it in the opinion that will be forthcoming in this particular matter. All right. Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your helpful arguments from both sides, and the matter will now stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. Thank you.